These guys do the work. They can tell you step by step what to do, what you need to look for and look out for. So that, you guys have it.
Thank you. Should we pass out the...
Yes.
That's probably a good idea.
Well, they're passing those out. We'll kind of just do our, I guess, our version of introductions. I've been doing real estate full time for going on 3.5 years, but I've been in the real estate space for going on four and a half. But I grew up in Kansas, small town, and I started doing construction when I was in high school for side money, and went to school for construction management. Did summer jobs construction, did internships construction, came down here doing construction, and after doing it full time on a large scale, I realized that it wasn't what I loved. And I found real estate and always kind of interested in it and started studying it and learning more about it, attending more meetings and networking. And I decided to go ahead and just go full time quit my job cold turkey and in 2015, 3.5 years later, still here doing it. So I guess I must be doing something right. So that's kind of my background. And John and I started working together in, I don't even know, I think 2015, shortly after, somewhere there. So we've been working together full-time. We did a lot of wholesaling when we started, because neither one of us came from really much of any financial background. So we kind of had to wholesale, then we had to really understand deal analogy, what people looked in a deal, why it was a deal, and gain credibility and knowledge and work our way up to where we can manage several rehabs and get to where we're at now. And then they asked us to go ahead and put this together. So pass over to John here.
So I'm the other John of Prime Homes. Grew up in New York. Family had a construction company remodeling houses. So my dad always, we're from Argentina, so as immigrants, you pretty much have two options. You either work or you study. I was terrible at school, so just dropped out and went to work. Working construction, I've worked for a lot of investors and builders, and I realized that I was doing all the heavy lifting and they were making all the money. So I was like, I already know how to build a house. Let me figure out how to buy one. So I started getting into real estate in New York. This was probably 2012, more or less. And it was just terrible. The banks weren't letting go of the property, so prices weren't dropping. Taxes were high. Rents were low. It just did not make any sense. So I did some research, found Texas, and did some more research, found San Antonio, and packed up the car and moved down here. So I've been down here going on 5 years this September. Yeah. And ever since I started, my beef with the gurus is that I read some books and I did some very inexpensive courses. And I thought, like at most gurus, like, I can do this myself. This is so simple. And when I started getting into it, I was like, holy crap, they left a lot of stuff out. You know, it's not as simple as they make it seem. So I'm very resourceful. It's one thing that I do like about myself is how resourceful I can be. So I started partnering with people. So I was like, I speak Spanish because I'm from Argentina. I know construction and I have time. So I just started partnering with people and just going to see houses, taking pictures, negotiating, getting contracts. And in return, they would give me a small split of the whatever the fee was, the wholesale fee, whatever it may have been. But they would teach me how to do the deals. And that way is how I learned how to do subject twos, wraps, and everything under the sun. I mean, pretty much done every type of strategy and combination of strategies out there. And we never lost the partnering aspect. We met because he's like, we joke around, but he's like literally the other half of what I suck at. So he likes the data, he understands title work, all of that. I'm good at sales and I'm good at homeowners and negotiating. So we made a good team and we started doing lead management. That's how we pretty much got into real wholesaling, is people paid for marketing and we would chase down the leads. So we'll take the calls, get the contracts, and whatever came out of it, we'll split it with them. And it kind of got the ball rolling, got our credibility going. And we wanted to get into actually flipping and to get back to partnering. So we partnered with somebody that had the money, and they brought the money, and we did all the work. We brought the deal and did the work. And little by little, we built our credibility there, where now people lend to us at very favorable rates. So now we pretty much just run it ourselves. But we still do a lot of partnering. And even right now, we're in a partnership with... What's his name?
Peter.
Peter from the Alamo. Mm-hmm.
Peter Michaels.
Peter Michaels, yes. So, you know, it's just a way to think differently for everybody getting started and stuff. That we really stress partnering because, I mean, it really helped us out a ton. So.
Yeah, there's a lot of deals that we've done or are doing that we don't get 100% of the profit. Yeah. It's like it diversifies the risk, and then it's a great way to find just that deals. Right now, is a lot of our deals have come this year, especially just like we're partnering other people just based on the credibility that we have built over time because we partnered with people in the past to learn how to do those things and build that credibility. So always stress partnering, especially if you're just starting out, is it finding what skill you do have and finding somebody who has what you need and partnering with that person to teach you. So that's kind of how we got started. So I guess we'll kind of go on to our presentation. I can't remember. I think it might have been Tim that called me. It was like the Friday before the Monday flip focus group. He's like, hey, you don't have to say yes, but you're kind of my last resort right now because I kind of got delayed and forgot to ask in time, but wanted to get you in there to do a scope of work and put a scope of work kind of presentation together. So it's like, well, we can put something together. So he asked us to put a presentation together, and we presented it there, and they asked us to do it here as well, just because him and I both grew up in construction and doing it our entire lives. So what is second nature to us, we realize some people have no idea what, we just don't even realize other people don't realize what to do, but we've just been doing it the whole time. So we just kind of put a little formal presentation together, not formal, we're very open.
Yes.
With the type of presentations we do. He didn't even want to put any PowerPoint slides together at first. Like, you gotta have something to look at. Get his talk. So if you have a question throughout while we're speaking, don't be afraid to kind of just raise a hand and ask a question, and we'll have more questions towards the end.
If we say stuff that you guys don't understand or you never heard the term or whatever, just that's the best way to learn. Just ask and we'll, you know, because we don't know what you don't know.
So we kind of morphed it from just putting a scope of work together based on the feedback we got and when we did the flip focus group, and they asked a lot of questions just how to just deal with contracts, how to handle, and somebody spoke about what you need to do versus you don't need to do, but somebody wants you to do. Because I always say there's two different types of value in a property. You have appraised value and you have intrinsic value. And intrinsic value doesn't bring you any more appraised value, but the intrinsic value is what makes your buyer want to pay a price. So there's certain things you have to kind of know and go between to get the highest and best price while keeping costs down to where you can still make profit in your deal. So everybody has presentation. So first page is basically just the kind of different things that we're going to go over tonight when it comes to managing rehab and just why you must put a scope of work together, why do you need one, how do you make one, what do you do with it, how you hire the right contractor, and how do you enforce it? Of course, your scope of work and working with the contractor. So, he always says I'm his work wife, so we just bicker back and forth at each other. So, what is it and why is it important? One thing that you can do with why it's important to put a good scope of work together is it helps you get accurate bids. So when you're going through and putting a scope of work together, you can literally, depending on how you put them together, there's different ways to do that. You can hand that person that scope of work and say, here's everything that I want you to do. So you don't, because if you just take your contractor and walk him through a house and expect him to write down everything you want you to do and say on his notepad and chicken scratches he's walking around, stuff will get it forgotten about and he'll give you a price and won't have anything written down. Because we've had that exact happens. Like, oh, here's my price, $15,000. What's included in that $15,000? Everything we said. Which was what?
Yeah.
So putting together an accurate, detailed scope of work helps to make sure not only that he's catching everything, but it's also making sure it's a double check that you put everything down there. So when you're looking over at the very end of the job, that it's kind of like a check mark. You can see, like, okay, all these things got done. and you can make sure that no hole is in your scope of work when you get to the end of the job, and you realized, and we know this from experience, we're like, we had nobody to change out all the outlet plugs. Crap, there's like 70 of them in this house. So what did we do on Saturday? We went out to change out all the electric plugs ourselves, because at the end of the job, we didn't have anybody do it, and we just kind of had to do it ourselves. So it allows you to help keep everything on track with your contractor and for you, and make your job sure your job goes through.
John, do you prefer questions as you go along?
Yes.
Or do you want them after?
No, go ahead as we do it, because if we get through the end, we can remember.
Okay. What do you use to do the detailed scope of work?
Yeah, do you have an example?
I really don't, because a lot of ours is like we literally just go room room by room is the way I like to do it. A lot of times is I go into a specific room, so I go, all right, in the bedroom number one, a master bedroom, is like I'm ripping up the carpet, I'm changing out the lights, I'm doing this, and then I go back and break it down. If I'm general contracting myself, I'll break it down to different contractors, or if I'm using a GC, then we'll hand it over that way. But I find it easier for myself to just go through, write down room by room, and then I have terrible handwriting, and then I'll go type in a Word
document. Okay.
Yeah, then I'll put in an actual something a little cleaner that I can save. I can print out multiple copies and kind of do it that way. But the first, I just go through room by room and write it all down by hand.
When you give them a scope of work, do you give it to them as a contractor, they have to sign, they have to pay all the work and they're being paid?
I think we go over that.
Yeah,
we go over that
we'll
in another section.
Exactly.
If I don't address exactly, ask that a little later. So,
I was going to say, you got to understand a lot of these women have not done any jobs with us forever. So
right.
You have to elaborate a little bit on what a scope of work is.
So, if I don't explain something, please, like I said, we've done our entire lives, so I don't know what you don't know because I've been doing it for so long.
So, we're going to break down exactly how we put a scope of work together, what it entails, how to look at a property when you're putting a scope to work together. Like, I mean, how do we look at the interior? How do we look at the exterior? So, we're going to go really step by step on how we pretty much write it all out ourselves.
So, I mean, that's why a scope of work is important, because it allows you to get accurate, detailed bids, double check if you missed anything when you read through it, and then it helps you kind of stay on track at the end of the job. You can say, okay, we actually did get everything we needed to done in the house, so I can make sure everything's kind of checked off.
And also with the staying on track, where it's been helpful for us is this year, fortunately, we've been able to do more than one flip. We've had to like four or five flips going on at the same time. And the issue with that is that sometimes unfortunately, we haven't done any small flips. They're all like 60 grand and up. So $60,000 flips, there's a lot of things involved, and sometimes they drag on for, you know, you're setting the mood. So it drags on for months. And when you have multiple flips, sometimes the contractor comes and says, you know, oh, what did you say about this corner here? I don't remember. Like, it was so long ago and I have three other projects. I don't know what I said about that corner. So you go back to the scope of work and you say, okay, we talked that we were going to do this in this corner, right? Because if it's not written down, it's not going to get done. Exactly. So if it's written down, it's a way for you to backtrack when you start doing multiple projects, or or they drag on for too long. That's a great way to have one. So you go back and you're like, no, here it is. I wrote it down. You agreed. This is what we're doing. You know, so keeping track is definitely helps.
Yeah. So now the next question is like, why do you need it? We touched on a lot of things, and we'll kind of reiterate it several different ways. I guess you don't. It's just convenient. So before you buy, it helps you to keep from underestimating repairs. And this is actually things we've like from experience on why we put these things in here, because there's several times like we put in there, the little things add up. Things that you just don't even realize cost money, but they really do. Like changing out all the door hardware. Like, who's installing that? I mean, and when I talk about the intrinsic value, like changing out door hardware, changing out outlet plugs, little things that just, they don't cost a lot of money to do, but they look really nice and clean when they're fresh. So, but if you don't remember to do those or put them in your scope of work at the beginning of the job that you're going to do it, does a contractor know he has to put it in there? And also keeps you from forgetting that I need to buy all those things. Those little things constantly add up. Light bulbs, something very simple, but when you have 85 light bulbs in a house and there's $16 for a 16 pack, and then you've got the hardware too for all your doors, that's like those little things can add up to $1,000, $2,000, $3,000 at the end of your job. So that is another thing of like, why do you need it? It keeps you from forgetting the little things, especially like we all live very busy lives. If you have kids, you have a job, you have a project, whatever it may be, it helps you keep from forgetting these things because you just way too much going on in your life. So it's a kind of protection thing. And I already touched on the tracking of your job. And so you can kind of keep it as a checklist of how your job's progressing as things get completed. And the accountability of, like John mentioned, your contractor needs to know what he needs to do. And if he says, well, you never told me that, and if you can go back to a scope of work and say, it was right there. Like, I don't know how you missed it. It was in the part of the contract we signed. It's in the agreement. You saw it. I saw it. Like, you need to do it. So it gives you something to go back in a hard fact and a piece of paper that it's written on with his signature, however you want to present it. It keeps him from doing that. And that allows you for protection from yourself forgetting things and allows you for protection from your contractors coming back to you and saying, hey, you never told me I needed to do that. I'm not going back and switching all the plugs out. And it's like, well, right here on that scope of work that hands you on day one that you bid, that you need to switch out all those plugs. So it gives a lot of protection for both sides.
So one of the biggest things in putting a scope of work together, what you're going to eliminate, and this is something that a lot of people I see make a mistake with contractors, is it depend very heavily on their experience. So they assume that the contractor knows what he's doing and that the contractor is going to do everything that makes sense to you. So you can't assume anything in a rehab, right? But the biggest example we had, the first one we hired a GC for, he did the demo. We paid him to do all the demos. So he demos the whole house, demos all the base moldings, everything. The bid was to remodel the whole house, right? He comes back afterwards and he says, what are you gonna do with the base moldings? I was like, well, base moldings. Oh, I didn't bid for that. I'm like, you ripped them off. What were you thinking you were gonna do? Like paint to the floor? I mean, you understand? Like, so I assumed he understood that he had to, if he ripped it off, you gotta put it back. So never assume anything. And I'm talking about the dumbest little things that even when I bring it up to a contractor, they'll look at me sometimes like, it's not the first time I've done this, you know? And I tell them, look, I'm not trying to disrespect you, but it has happened. So I want to make sure that you understand that this is the finished product that I expect.
That's exactly what I'm talking about, because I get caught between, you know, I'm not going to pretend I know something that I don't know.
Correct.
I come from an education background. I'm not a contractor. That's why I'm hiring the contractor.
Yep.
And those people are so skilled, and I have such great respect for what they accomplish. I know I can do what he can do, but I'm assuming he can do it.
Right.
And so I talk to him and I say, have you done this before? Oh, yeah. And then when the job is, you know, halfway through, he's knocking windows out with a hammer and glass all over the yard. I'm thinking, where is your mind?
Oh, yeah.
I mean, so I'm caught between holding them in awe and feeling so enamored by what the finished product that I see that contractors do.
I use
and the process to get there. And yet I can't talk to them like, sometimes I've said to my contractors, you're smarter about this than I am. I really need to know from your expertise that it ended up. Well, now did I just cut my throat?
Yes.
Yeah, I just depends.
Confess to them that I don't know if they can take advantage of it.
Yeah. I always said when I was working on the large scale construction commercial, it was like, managing construction, managing contractors is a lot like babysitting. Uh-huh. You got kids. They can be the most disciplined angels, and you know they can, But if you give them an inch of leeway, they are drinking Mountain Dew and hanging from the ceiling fans and just going crazy. And that's where they start smashing glass. They start taking spray paint out of cleaning their spray guns after painting out your front yard that you're getting ready to sell, driving their cars, parking underneath trees. So you really need to, while they do great work, you still need to direct them and point them in the right direction and say, don't do this, you can do that.
I guess I just thought, if you knew how much I respected you, you'd really want to come back to this.
No. So we're gonna cover in there like how we hire our contractors. So we're gonna talk about kind of like the vetting process that we do, because of that same thing that everybody knows how to do everything.
They all have 30 years of experience.
Yeah, everybody has 30 plus years of experience. Everybody's been in this their whole lives, and all the nonsense you want to hear. So we're going to cover exactly, you know, how to combat that, okay, even with no experience yourself.
Okay. And should I not say that? I mean, I can't pretend I know.
Well, we'll go over it.
Use the timeline of snowboard.
Yes. So,
very soft one. Yeah. They all overpromise and underdeliver every time. As I guess it's a common thing, and it's very hard to, in large scale, the number, the higher up you get, and you can do what's called like damages, liquidated damages, of saying like, if you don't complete on this time frame, you have to start paying me money. What you're gonna do there is your contractor's gonna start realizing he's gonna start getting behind, and he's just gonna disappear. So you can push for a timeline, but we haven't gotten to the point where we have to like put a dollar sign to it, because it doesn't help anybody out when that really happens. So we discuss the timeline, but we know realistically that it's always going to go over. So yeah.
Let's say you did institute liquidated damages and your GC left. What is your next recourse?
That's the other problem on small scales. You're really going to try to sue over some money, little small amounts of money? Well, like,
it depends on the amount.
Well, that's the other, like, and then like suing for construction, one, you got to hire an attorney, and if they hire another attorney, you're out of pocket there, and then if you go the back and forth, your attorney is $150, $200, $300 an hour, and the amounts that it's going to cost to sue, is it really going to be worth anything? And then it comes down to, if you do win, does he even have money to even pay you? Most of the contractors in our business, our realm, don't have much of any savings at all. So it's usually, they'll just run off and you never hear from them again, and you kind of have to find another contractor to start all over.
Which is where the babysitting comes into play very strongly, because if you babysit them, and I'm talking about you got to be at the job every single day, you can prevent things from getting out of hand too much. So it minimizes your risks. You know, and your expenses is a little bit more, but what you got to keep in mind through this whole process, that there is no safe way of working with contractors. Like, I mean, there's always a risk in real estate investing. There's always going to be a risk. You're one contractor away from losing money, from taking a big hit on your deals. It doesn't matter how much experience you have.
Well, you know? Jonathan, okay. You say you're going to tell us how to vet a GC. And I would imagine hiring the right one is similar to getting the right tenant into your property for a rental. That isn't there a list of best practices? I mean, if you see your general contractor is smoking in the house and that you've already told them your expectation,
yeah.
Isn't there an industry best practices list somewhere?
It's whatever you put together.
Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, being the owner, it's what you expect.
It's what you're able to tolerate, not tolerate. I mean, and as far as going after them, we go back to the same thing. A lot of times, I mean, you can go to maybe small claims court, unless it's a massive project and, you know, you're talking about tens of thousands of dollars in damages. Then okay, but if you're talking about a couple thousand dollars?
Well, in your vetting process, do you have any line item on your list of vetting, checking references.
Yes. Yeah, so we'll cover that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So now we have, so how do you really make a scope of work? And a lot of times we say, like, if you don't know, ask another investor. There's multiple ways to do it. You can just kind of, a lot of investors will do it for free if they have the time. You might just say, hey, can you come out to a property that you already own or property you're looking at? It's like, I'll pay you some money or I'll pay for your dinner. Will you help me kind of put together a scope of work and walk me through the project? So if you don't know what you're looking at or what needs to be done and what doesn't need to be done, just ask somebody else. Network, partner with another investor, see somebody that's got some experience and ask. It's like you can more than happy to shoot us an email, and if we're in the area and availability, more than happy to just kind of walk through and say, hey, give you an hour or two just to walk through and just kind of help put together a scope of work. So that's probably the most effective way to learn how to do that stuff, because everybody's got different ways of doing it. Some people have the set templates, so this is how you do it. The stuff that we write, it's like I said, room by room, write it down, type it on Word. So it's whatever works for you, but if you don't know how to put one together, ask somebody. That's probably one of the most effective ways to...
When asking an investor, especially in San Antonio, ask an investor that has renovated a house in the area that you're renovating a house. What I mean by this is that you may know an investor that flips a lot of houses in the historic district, and you're going to ask him to help you put a scope of work together in a house in 78247, right? So the problem is that it's a very different type of rehab. So they're probably going to come in here and tell you, oh, you need to put barn doors everywhere and reclaim wood. And it's not that kind of area, right? Maybe you're in a more newer area where you don't need those kind of finishes. So it definitely helps when you're flipping in a certain area to get investors that have flipped in that area, because we've dealt in areas of houses that are built in the 70s that have aluminum wiring. If an investor doesn't know that because they never flipped a house that's built in the 70s, they're not going to know to tell you, be careful with the aluminum wiring, because you can't just switch out the plugs to the new ones that have the copper fittings. They don't, copper and aluminum apparently don't like each other. So those things, only an investor that's renovated in those areas is going to be able to help you with that. You know, so definitely when you ask for help, make sure it's from the right person, not just whoever's available.
And you put on here, you're going to pay for one way or another. If you're asking an investor or you try to jump into a job and you don't have a good scope of work because you're trying to cut money, it's going to cost you at the very end because you're going to miss things. You're going to have the little things get caught up. Nobody put in switching out plugs. So it's going to cost one way or another, and it's always better to spend a little money up front or ask somebody up front to really get it set it up right so it can run through the job successfully.
And a lot of investors are really cheap. Like, don't feel bad, like, you know, that, oh, how much is it going to cost me? Usually if you just take them out to lunch, they'll help you out a ton. I mean, you know, if they're a decent investor, like, we're not going to try to be like, oh, my hourly rate is this. Because my hourly rate is to work at my business. Like, it's not to consult, right? So if you say, hey, you know, let's walk a house and we'll go out to lunch, I'm down. You know, like, it's not a, don't overthink it. Good investors are not going to overcharge you, but understand that this is a renovation. This is a house. You're talking about tens of thousands of dollars. Buying the house, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of dollars. Like, don't take it lightly. You know, if you can get help, get help. It's going to help.
And we always say, wouldn't recommend asking your contractor to help you put a scope of work together, because he's also the person you're paying to do the work. So, of course, he's going to tell you to put the expensive fixtures, change out everything, do way more than you need to. It's like, we hear a lot of people ask, and it's one of his, like, biggest pet peeves, an investor-friendly contractor. And he did a whole, like, podcast on the thing, and he just, like, went on and on and on and on and on. It's like, there's no such thing. There isn't one, because you're the investor. You know what to put into a house. You're the one that needs to know how to invest and actually have the profit make money. He's a contractor. He makes money by doing contracting work. So it's two different things. You can ask for advice on what he would do in a certain area, but you need to know what it is the end product needs to be. Like, you say, hey, I want to reconfigure this kitchen a little bit, like remove this wall. Like, what are some ideas that I could do? What are my options? So kind of weigh those out and see which is the best way to do it. But don't go to your contractor, say, get the investor-friendly contractor, say, hey, how should I fix this house? Because they're going to go through and fix everything. We were just speaking about or earlier about a fence situation. Or our contractor, we have neighbor's wood fence, our chain link fence, and their fence just looks like crap falling down, and they don't want to give any money to do it right. So just break it down and put it up. And our contractor, we told him, hey, we're just going to run a new fence on the inside of that chain link fence, and whenever they tear their crap one down, they can deal with the chain link fence. Now, it seems kind of crappy that we're leaving that chain link fence there, but we told him that, and he came back and says, no, the thing's falling over. We got to tear it down. We got to rip it all up because it's just not, I can't put the fence in right if it's still there. And then I'm going to charge you a dump fee, $150, to take care of all that stuff. And the problem is, when we bought the house, we got a new survey. Well, if you replace, there's a thing when you sell a house called a T47 affidavit that goes with that survey. If you have an existing one that asks you, have you modified anything on the property or the exterior from the last time a survey was done? Fencing is included in that. So if we were to tear down that fence, we're not only paying him an extra money to tear it down, labor man hours, the extra money to haul it off, now we've got to go pay for a new survey because that new fence was there. And we just had this happen on a recent property where we put a lot of new fencing in. But we took pictures of where the new fencing was, and when we sent it to the title company, the underwriter looked at it, he said, here's our fence, we put our new fence on the inside of it. That property line was on that fence, so we didn't modify the barriers of the property line. Here's a telephone pole, we went on the inside of the telephone pole, we're 8 inches to a foot inside our property line, and they were fine with it. So that would have cost us a lot of money by doing it what the contractor wanted to do, taking all the time saying it's the right way to do it, but since we know it's like, actually, I want to stay here, I tell them that, you don't want to do it, fine, I'll get somebody else to do it, but that's where I want our fence because it's going to save us money. So you can't always ask your contractor what he wants to do, so you've got to have some knowledge with that.
So, and the problem with asking a contractor, and this comes from experience, again, like I told you, when I was like, I can build a house, so why not learn how to buy a house? It's two different things, knowing how to do the construction and knowing how to flip a house, right? I may know what needs to get done to fix the house, make it look pretty, but I'm not going to know, I did not know what's going to bring the most value to that property, right? Like, I would do what I used to do on the remodels and say, you know, let's put granite countertops, let's put tile backsplash because it looks beautiful. But in certain areas, you're just not going to get that value back. So an investor knows that, a contractor doesn't, you know, and that's a warning that I give a lot of contractors that tell me I want to get into flipping, and I tell them the same thing. It's like, just because you know construction doesn't mean you know how to flip a house. Like, you still need to try to work with an investor, somebody that can tell you, you know, and you do that by running comps and doing all that. You need to know what it is that each house is going to need so you don't go over or under the necessary rehab.
Yep. And then we put in here, like, beware the inspector. And when I say that, I'm talking about the inspector at the very end of your job when you've got a new buyer. They're going to hire a home inspector. They're going to mortgage if they're going to require it. His sole job is to make your house look like the biggest turd ever. I mean, rip it to shreds. And you just put a lot of money fixing all kinds of things. His job is to find everything in that house and make it look terrible. So working... just from experience, and it doesn't take very many houses to kind of see like what an inspector looks like, because that realtor is going to come to you and say, oh, we want all these things fixed. So knowing those things kind of going in of what an inspector is going to look like, and we kind of put in things in here of like what to look for, the foundations, bathroom, electric panels, and wood rot. So keeping in mind that an inspector is going to go through that job and tear your house apart to try to mitigate that stuff from... mitigate that problem as much as possible. So when it comes to making one, things to look for in a property, there's obviously some of the big ones, like the foundation. South Texas, I grew up in Kansas, we have like 8-10 foot basements underneath there, so like we never had foundation issues, but it's a huge problem down here. Some of the indicators are doors that open and close by themselves. It's not supposed to happen. It's not a selling feature, trust me. The inspector will put that on there and say, like, that's a problem. Hooks coming off of windows and doors. And the reason, and when I say a hook, so basically your door frame is square. And you'll see some of them that kind of come up vertical and horizontal and straight lines. That's not a biggest issue when you see one kind of hooking like this. Kind of looks like a big J. And what that's really what's causing that is your house is settling, and you have behind the sheetrock is you've got a wood frame around that, and it's being twisted like this. You have uneven settling, which is pulling the sheetrock and everything apart and splitting those cracks. That's why they crack like that. So it's an indication that there is some serious foundation problems. And a lot of times people will cover that up because they don't know what it is. So one of the first things I do walking every house is I get really close to every window, or not every window, but I get close to the windows and doors and kind of look to see if they've modified that at all. And some of the things down here is we have a lot of texture. Texture is very hard to match if you get really close to it and look at it. So if you can see that there's some modified texture there, somebody's painted up, because I've walked into several houses that an investor already was trying to sell, and you go into it and look, and you can see they try to cover those things up. And you kind of can see the shape of what it was underneath. If it's got that uneven J hook, you know there's some kind of unsettling, or it's going to raise a flag that, hey, we got some settling that might be uneven. So that's some things to look for, is the doors opening and closing by themselves and those hooks coming off, and especially in the brick on the exterior. They love using brick and limestone down here. If it's stair-stepping up the mortar line, so you have your bricks, and if you got this, it kind of makes a stair step up on the side. I'm not as worried about that unless there's like, I can stick my finger in the gap, then I'm worried about it. But when it goes through the brick and it cracks straight through the brick and it put a vertical line and it's not following the mortar lines, because everything's going to move down here. Concrete shifts, the ground shifts. So over time, mortar in itself, it's understandable to have some mortar cracks in there. But if I see it cutting straight through that brick, that means that brick snapped in half. It had two different forces coming from two different angles, and it broke that brick in half and made that crack go straight through. So that's another indication from the outside.
And then also, like with foundations, what I see a lot of, sometimes I've gone to houses with wholesalers or new investors that they're negotiating with the seller, and we go around the house and I tell them, take pictures of every room, and they go in a room, okay, yeah, this is a bedroom, and they take a picture and walk out, and I'm like, no, go in the room. Like, because sometimes, you know, looking at the room like this, it's not enough. Like, walk into a room. Look at the base molding. Are you going to have to change those? Look at the light fixtures. Look at the air vents. Are they, you know, black? Do you got to change them? Do you got to paint them? All those things keep going back to the little things that add up. And the foundation cracks and everything. Sometimes you look at it from over here and you're like, oh, it looks good. But you walk next to it, and all of a sudden when the light hits it separately, you can see that they patched over it. So if they patched over it, sometimes they fix the foundation, which is why they patched it. Great. Ask for a report. But if they don't have one, they just patched over it. You know, and these are all little indications that it's going to give you the reason to ask for a foundation bid, so you can see what you're actually dealing with.
Exactly. And if you do have foundation problems, you're going to have plumbing issues. Like some people will tell you, like, oh, some of the big wholesale outfits here, they'll say, oh, here's your foundation bid. And you ask them, what about plumbing? Oh, we don't know. I was like, well, yeah, it could break. Well, we don't know that. And like, I'm going to bet that it's going to break. If you're lifting more than 2 inches, and we've lifted anywhere from 4 to 6 inches before, and we've snapped plumbing almost every time. And that's something that does cost, and it's not cheap. And you can't get a bid on it because you don't know what's going to break. So it's kind of up in the air what that's really going to do. And if you are getting your foundation bid, ask the foundation guy where the piers are going. Not a lot of them, or several of them, won't give you a report where they're going to put the piers. They'll say, hey, here's my bid. Ask them, like, hey, where is the elevation differences in my house? And then think of where your water is in your house. You have your kitchens and your baths. So if you go to your foundation guy and walk through the house with him and say, where is the biggest difference in the house? And he goes, oh, it's 4 inches, but it's over there in the back bedroom. And all of your plumbing is on this side of the house. So where are you putting the piers? He goes, oh, we're just putting 10 piers over here. You're probably not going to break plumbing on that. But a lot of times these houses, the 3-2s, you have kitchen, bathroom, bathroom. It's like, and you're lifting over on this side, you're probably going to snap some plumbing in that. So go ahead and just figure, like, I'm going to break it. What's it going to cost? You kind of just got to put a number at it. My thing is that I figure it's probably about half of whatever my foundation bid is going to be. So if I have a $20,000 foundation bid, I'm probably going to spend $8,000 to $10,000 in plumbing in that bid. But you just need to ask, where are you lifting in this house? I mean, foundation problems, I mean, that's a pretty big thing to do. I wouldn't recommend if your first property getting into foundation work because a lot of it goes along with that. But when you are making a scope of work, keep those things in mind. Just kind of think your way through the project on how and what needs, what you're fixing.
I have another question. On the foundation bid, if it's an older house, it has cedar piers.
Pier and beam.
Pier and beam, yes, and you need cedar. In what circumstance you would replace by the concrete? If the cedar is all rotten, or if it's not rotten, just continue to use it, or since you're already elevating it, just go ahead and replace it.
The city wants to get rid of all cedar posts.
I don't think it's an option.
But, I mean, it depends if you're how extensive work you're doing and what and who you're hiring to do here in Dean. If you're going to have to lift the whole house and you're going to have to get permits, the city's going to make you replace everything underneath there. But obviously you can't put a new cedar post under there. So if you're just lifting one corner and just kind of lifting it, doing some modifications to it, you might be able to get away with just adding a few new concrete ones. But I can't say from experience what the inspection would look like on the other end because I've never done it. We have gone through and put all new piers on it, but I don't know what that would be like on the inspection side of it. So that really kind of answers.
They don't like cedar piers, period. So, I mean, you know, if you're going to do any foundation work, that's the risk that you're kind of having. So it's all a risk-reward basis. I mean, we do a lot of stuff that it's risky to some people. Like, I mean, there's a way that you can do a flip that protects you to the last letter, right? But the chances of you doing business that way is going to be very, very, very small because you're going to need very big profit margins to protect you in every step of the way. So there's sometimes that you got to take some risks and you kind of got to determine where is it worth taking that risk, you know? And on a pier and beam with cedar post, I mean, how big of a risk is it, you know?
And so something we at the next section here, like bathrooms, we should have added kitchens with that too. If you don't, vanity from the outside looks fine when you're buying the house. Open the cabinets and look underneath, because if there is rot in the bottom, and you're not going to get away with that in your inspection report. Like, it's going to get flagged. We always say, like, beware the inspector. If he sees water damage on there, he's going to flag that, put it on there. So if it's bowing on the bottom, you're going to have to wind up just replacing that whole vanity. So when you're putting together scope of work, it's like, oh, if there's water anywhere near there, like, open up and see, like, okay, is there any leaks? Something you can do on copper fittings around water heaters. If you see a lot of green corrosion building up around the fittings, that's not natural. It's not supposed to be there. That means there is a very small leak, and the calcium is reacting with the air since we have so much calcium here, and it's building little deposits, and the copper's turning it green. So if you see those discolorations, you see water drops, or if the water's turned off, it's been turned off for a while, and you see those water marks going across the ground that kind of look like an uneven flame in a kind of an odd circle. I was like, water's been dripping there from somewhere, and it could create rot. And then what goes with a damp, moist area that can't dry properly? Mold. And that is the death sentence to a property when an inspector puts on there, oh, there could be black mold. Oh, forget it. Forget it. So always avoid that. So if there's a chance that there's water somewhere, look for that stuff. When you're putting together your scope of work. The electrical panels.
Can I add termites to water? Water damage if you're using a water source.
Yeah, and I mean, that's usually a lot of the newer homes have slabs, and where the water is on the inside of the house, you usually don't have termites. It's more on the exterior that you kind of see it. One way you can look for termites is you'll get these little, looks like just little mud veins that kind of go up to your house. So that shows that there's an active termite infestation there. It just looks like a little mud spot on the side of the house, and you can go over there and just knock it off, because it's actually just like a little tunnel that they've come up from the ground and built up the side of your house into the house, and now eating your wood. So, but if you have, do have a kitchen that's on the exterior house, you do have plumbing that runs behind there. So if you see in the back wall, it creates termites and it can create mold. So that's something you can add to that as well. Anything else?
So going through the interior of the house, pretty much, a lot of people, the mistake they make is that you go in, you say, I need a new kitchen, new bathrooms, new floor, new paint. Okay. You know, that, those are usually when a wholesaler brings me a deal, that's what they tell me. But what else do I need, right? If I'm putting new floors, am I leaving the base molding there and butting the new floor to that? Then I need a shoe molding, right? So I need to know, I need to factor that in. That needs to get installed, needs to get purchased, it needs to get painted. The same thing in the kitchens, like I'm putting a new kitchen in. Okay, those are the cabinets, granite countertop, that's common sense. But the hardware, did you factor in how are the cabinets going to open up, right? Are you going to put recess lights in? It's a lot of little things that you keep having to go back to, because again, a contractor is going to say, yeah, I can do a kitchen for $5,000. But what does that mean? You know, you can do it for five. What's doing the kitchen for $5,000 mean? So every little detail as you go through the house, going back to hardware, light switches, your fixtures, your appliances. A lot of people forget appliances. We forgot appliances. if you're doing electrical and stuff like that, you're putting exhaust fans in the bathrooms. If you're doing AC duct, are you putting ductwork in the laundry rooms? All these little things as you're going through the house. It's not just the kitchen or the bathroom. It's all the little stuff within all that. Are you changing all the quarter turns in the plumbing throughout the whole house? Are you changing, because sometimes they're very old and they're always on, they're always leaking, you can't turn them off. So you replace them with quarter turns. They're updated little plumbing fixtures, right? Somebody needs to do that work, right? And usually it's a plumber and they're gonna charge you for that.
And if you forget, every time a plumber comes out to your house, they usually charge you like $95 trip fee.
Yeah.
So we had this happen on the last one. I ordered a vanity from Lowe's, where, and I bought them several times before, and the cabinet on both sides, sink in the center, four foot, was perfect. And they had 35 of them on Friday. When I went to pay for it on Tuesday, the whole company was out nationwide. And they're like, okay, well, I need to get a new vanity. So I order a new, I just go through their thing real quick, find one comparable, buy it. The problem was, all of the cabinet space was on one side. So the access panel to the plumbing was now on the left side, where the plumbing in the wall was dead center. So it didn't fit. So I had to call a plumber back out there. And he charged $95 trip fee, because he had to move the plumbing literally a foot and extend everything. But he also had to cut a piece of sheetrock out of the thing this big. So then I had to pay somebody to come out there and fix that stuff. So keeping those things in mind and asking those questions is important when you're kind of going through and like putting your scope of work together. And wood rot is something that you're not going to get away with, especially if it's a VA or FHA loan. And a lot of properties you do, if they're under 200,000, and chances in San Antonio are pretty high that it's going to be an FHA or VA buyer. And they do not, especially the VA, like any type of wood rot anywhere visible. So if you see some wood rot and they're like, oh, we can just paint over that, you're not going to be able to paint over that. Because you can paint over it, but then you're going to pay your guy back out there to fix it and put it up there and change it out. So when you're going through, that's kind of the thing with beware the inspector, is knowing that, hey, you're going to have to replace any kind of wood rot and fascia, especially siding. There's a lot of the siding that it needed to be painted every year, and they didn't paint, or every couple of years, and they didn't paint it for two decades. And it's like, oh, you can, the wholesaler's like, just paint over it, you'll be fine, and it's still good. And it's mushy when you touch it, like, you're not going to get away with that. So things that you need to kind
of... And the problem with wood rot, a lot of times, it's, you see it on the surface, so you think it's just that piece. But a lot of times it goes in, you know, and if it's hitting your walls inside, and it's, that's a lot, it could get very costly. And we had it on a house where we had to change a lot of the interior beams and every 2x4s and stuff. And that siding is old, so they don't make that siding anymore. And we only needed to change out the bottom 2 feet. But we didn't want to replace the siding of a 2-story house.
2,700 square feet.
So yeah, that's a lot of siding. So we, you know, it was a problem that we overlooked. We saw a little bit of wood rot. We thought it's a little bit of wood rot. That's it. No, it was extensive. It was mushy, and we just, like I tell people, don't be an animal, but kick the wall a little bit. Like test it out, see if it, you know, if your shoe goes through it, because that's something that. It's really bad damage there. So, I mean, you know, you got to get creative with those things and really pay attention. Don't overlook them because it can get very expensive.
Yeah. The next slide is you made one. Now what? And this is where you asked your question earlier about how we put one together if we have a template or anything like that. It depends how I put one together or... I put one together pretty much the same way every time, and that's usually just mine. That I dissect and separate into different areas. So it depends if you're hiring one main contractor, like a GC, or if you're subcontracting thing out yourself. If you're doing less than $20,000 in rehab, probably $25,000, $30,000, you're probably not hiring one guy to do everything. Because you just need some flooring, you're going to need some paint, you're going to need just a few miscellaneous things. So I'm not going to put one detail scope of work and hand it to every contract and say, oh, I just want you to do this one area. So when I'm putting, if it's just one main contractor, like if we're hiring a GC, I give them, yes, my entire scope of work, room by room, the entire house of what I do. And usually what I break it down is, what am I going to do through the entire house? If I'm putting new flooring everywhere, I don't go and say bedroom one, new flooring, kitchen, new flooring, living room, new flooring. I kind of put the main house like all new doors, all new hardware, all new flooring, paint everywhere, and that kind of goes in the main house. I don't break it down room by room. It's things when I walk in the room is saying, hey, we're going to switch out this ceiling fan and we're going to put just an LED light. So some of the bedrooms might not have anything as far as when you get to the actual room, but in the entire house, you're putting new flooring and painting that entire room. So you can put like closet door, or if you're just changing out the fan, or there's really not a whole lot, putting in some new shelves, there's not a whole lot you can get to in just like the secondary guest bedrooms. So that's kind of how we put it together. Just depends on what type of contractor you're really using and what the extent of your whole rehab really is.
Since generally you have multiple bedrooms, do you number the bedrooms so that everybody's on the same page as to this is bedroom number one, number two, number three?
Only if there's going to be something different done. Typically, the only bedroom that's different to us is the master. Every other bedroom after that, it's done exactly the same. I mean, we put the same, like, the same everything in them. The only one different is the master that, you know, the master bedroom. So you want to be specific on that one. On all the other bedrooms, it's all the same stuff. You know, it just bedrooms, period. This is what you got to do. So closet doors, I mean, whatever you may have to do as far as that goes.
Mm-hmm.
So, I have a question too. Yep. When you give contractor orders, when you say paint the entire room, in your definition, what does it?
So you got to be specific. It's not paint the entire room. Like, I want the walls this color, I want the ceiling this color with this quality paint, and I want the base moldings this color. So you got to be specific, because I could tell him, you know, I want you to paint the room, and again, he can assume I just mean the walls, right? So you want to tell him exactly the windowsills. You know, I want you to paint the windowsills. I want you to paint them the color of the moldings.
Tell them the colors, because we've had a guy who literally just painted everything the same color. It's like, why was like, have you ever seen a color of a windowsill the same color of the wall?
Yeah.
Like, usually they're white, like the trim. That's part of the trim. Ask that guy who painted those things white. Some contractors are insulted by that, but you have to put it there, and you just kind of tell them, like, hey, I'm not trying to be insulting, but literally had somebody not do that in the past.
Yeah.
So, I mean, explain to yourself that way, and they were like, oh, okay, I get it. And you can kind of crack a joke with like some of these contractors, right? And they kind of laugh over it. So that's, just tell them, like, that's why I put it that way, just to make sure. They usually will because they have to like clean their gun, their spray guns and stuff like that, or they have to. A lot of guys will roll the ceilings, or they'll spray the ceilings and roll the walls. So it kind of adds a little different to it, but it's usually not too much. Usually, when I'm going into a house, I kind of figure it's anywhere from $2.50 to $3 a square foot if I'm just doing everything, like ceiling, walls, trim, and stuff like that. But it also depends how intricate the house is. Like if it's just a basic square house, KB style home, doesn't have a lot of angles or two tone, it's like probably on the cheaper end around the $2.50 square foot. But if there's a lot of angles, big vaulted ceilings, it's got beams come out of the ceiling, I'm gonna have different colors. It's very hard to put just a generic number to that because there's so much involved with that. So when you've made one, either break it down to like the one main contractor detailed, and then you can put the entire house and break it out by room. But if you have multiple subcontractors, you make sure you get detailed of what exactly he wants to do in each room or different areas. And then you kind of take it off of the main one you did. So when you break it out to your separate contractors, you can go back and put a check mark next to it to make sure you got everything on your scope of work in somebody's scope of work when you're handing it to individual contractors.
So where does that talk to fit in? Like if you're taking out baseboards and everything, and they're just going to, you know, the contractor go ahead and put that in there, is that the painter that's going to go back and talk about that, the contractor that put in the baseboard?
Typically, like when we used to do trimming, like the company, my company, it was, if we installed the trim, we called it. Because, I mean, it's part of the finished product, right? If I put something new, it needs to look new and not like I just slapped it on. So that I take that as part of my job. But again, you got to be specific with them. So if somebody's doing the trim, you tell them you're installing the trim and you're caulking the trim. Right, so if they say, "Oh, I don't," for whatever reason, that they don't caulk. Now you got to make sure that you say to the painter, "I want you to caulk everything, right, and seal everything up."
Yeah, because they'll say it's like, "Oh, that's a flooring guy."
Yeah,
I'll try to put on the flooring guy, and then it's a common one that like who does it because they both touched it. But I always say it's like, don't touch the trim until my flooring's done, because then you got to come back and paint the trim, especially if you're taking a new flooring down, you're not taking off that baseboard and that trim piece, and you're doing like what they call the quarter round. Because now someone's got to come back and paint that in. So usually we put that on the painter, like saying, "Hey, I want you to caulk all the trim that you put down on the ceilings and stuff like that." You had a question?
You guys source and supply all of your materials for coverage and such? Or do you say this is what I want you to
do? Usually we tap. We tell most of them that we're going to provide the material, just for the fact that, one, we can get better discounts on those things. Well, you can go to Lowe's and open what's called a Lowe's Accounts Receivable at their Pro Desk, or Pro Desk is at Home Depot, but they do the same thing. And I can go charge things to that account, and they give me a 5% discount on everything I charge to it. So a lot of times we'll say, "Hey, we'll go get it." Painters, usually, I'll tell them just to provide the paint because they have a specific, if I like the price, it's good. I'll just get whatever paint you want to get, because they, a lot of times they have a certain type of paint that they like to work with, because some of the cheaper stuff that I want to pay, I was like, "Yeah, I don't want to buy the $150 a 5 gallon. I want to buy the $70 for a 5 gallon. But it's a much cheaper, watered down paint. For the painter is going to hate it, because he's going to, when he knows that you want a good looking product, so he's going to have to paint that wall 2 or 3 times, where the other product, he might have to just paint it once and go back and touch up a few areas because it's a thicker paint. So, and stuff like that.
And providing the material, you got to be very careful that you understand what you're providing, in the sense that, let's say, like my tile guy, right? Every time I hire him, I provide him with the tile, the grout, and if he does our showers, the little a little trim piece, a little metal piece that goes on the edge of the shower and makes it look really nice. He provides the thin set and the dirt rock that goes on the shower walls and the thin set to actually put down the tile. You got to be clear on that, right? Because if I show up with just tile and he didn't plan on providing thin set or whatever, now you got to go back and buy your thin set and buy all the extra stuff.
Is that something you negotiate with them? Like you say, I'll provide the tile around the metal piece and you provide the rest?
A lot of times it's a conversation. So it's a conversation that you just have with them because like my tile guy, he likes providing the Duroc and the thin set because he has it. Like sometimes he has it left over from jobs or whatever it may be. Well, he charges me for the install, and that's part of the install.
Yeah. So it really just kind of depends. A lot of the definitely the finished stuff, we provide all that because that's the stuff that they see. And that's kind of what I tell if I'm going to the contract. Like, if it's an installation, like a screw, I was like, I'm not going to provide you all your screws. You can provide your screws, your nails, your tools, and stuff like that. I figure that's just general stuff you should have around for a job. So if I can see it, I'm probably going to lean more towards I want to provide it because then I can be the one to pick it out. Because we hired a general contractor one time and he picked all the paint colors out and we showed the color swatches. He's like, oh, these are the colors we're going to use. Okay, yeah, it looks good. And then now I went through the end of the job, I'm like, this is some really dark gray. And I really wish we would have gone with a lighter gray. Looked good on the little thing he had, but yeah. When he put it in the walls everywhere, and it has a dark gray floor and a dark gray wall, and all the windows kind of have like patios and awnings over them, it's kind of dark in that room. It makes it seem smaller. And so those are things we try to say I lean towards, I want to provide it. But like painters, tile guys, when he talks about the thin set, that's the stuff that goes on the ground first and the tile goes over the top of it to stick it down. That's installation stuff. Like they can provide those things.
I was showing a house that had a brand new kitchen and then I looked. You do realize that not a single one of these cabinet cupboards match. I kid you not, it was 7 different cupboard styles. Some doors. And I was like, who is this?
Yeah.
They went to Habitat for Humanity and picked out. And I mean, don't get me wrong, like you can find great stuff at Habitat for Humanity, but it also depends on the style of house you're doing. If you just have a rental that's like, you're charging $500 for, it's like that guy just looks for, he's looking for a roof over his head. Like, you know, doesn't need fancy stuff, but if you're looking to sell it, like, you're probably not going to sell it seven different types of cabinets.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. They're
also, another tip on your scope of work, if you're renovating a house, let's say in the 80s, I don't know if in the 90s they have that problem too, but you want to make sure you get an electrician in there to make sure that you have GFCIs wherever they need to be. So those are the plugs that have that little reset button in the middle. They need to be within 4 feet of, if there's any water near it, there needs to be a GFCI. Because we updated a house that was from the 80s, and I mean, we didn't touch the electrical at all. We just left it as it was. And that was one of the things that we got hit for. The inspector says there's no GFCIs. And apparently back then, or whoever did the update, they just never put them in. So that's something that the inspector tried. Well, the inspector hit us with that. The homeowner got a, you know, Google electrician to come out. He bid them like $3,000 to change those. We're like, no, we're going to get our electrician out there for $500 and change those, you know, and we'll give you, we'll comply with what he says, and that's fine, but since we're not giving you $3,000 when it costs us $5,000 to do it, $500 to do it. So that's another thing to keep in mind is electrical, all things need to be up to date as well.